Today I'm going to be talking to you about filament dynamics. Filament dynamics, which is a little bit different than this morning's talk. In particular, I'm going to be presenting an exact solution that we have found for an extensional flow of viscoelastic fluid. This work began as part of my PhD research with Andrew Belmonte and Diane Henderson at Penn State. And all the experiments I'll be showing you, I did at the Pritchard Fluids Lab at Penn State. And now I'm a postdoc at Duke, and I've been working on top finishing up this problem. So just an overview of my talk. I'm going to tell you the background about liquid filaments and the dynamics of what we know about Newtonian filaments. I'm going to tell you a little bit about viscoelastic fluids, and I'll also show you a little bit about viscoelastic filaments, and this is sort of the show and tell portion of the talk. It's some of the stuff won't be relevant to the talk. And we're going to be considering a free boundary problem, the free boundary problem for a viscoelastic filament, drive an exact solution, and compare our predictions to experimental data. So there are lots of applications in industry and manufacturing related to filaments and drops, in particular inkjet printing, agricultural spraying, fiber drawing, where they make fiber optic cable. In this case, they start with molten glass from Corning, and they extrude out of it a filament. And the point here is you don't want a cable with any perturbations because you would like the optical quality to be very good. Also, fiber spinning. These are ways that we make synthetic fibers such as Kevlar and Lycra. And we learned this from spiders where they actually weave silk. These are non-Newtonian fluids. So the general free boundary problem for liquid filament that we'll be considering is a cylindrical filament in which the ambient fluid is inviscid and is at rest. The natural coordinate system to use here is cylindrical coordinates. We're going to assume this is infinitely long, gravity acting downwards. We'll be looking for velocity fields that are axisymmetric, and again we're using cylindrical coordinates. Governing equations will want an incompressible fluid, the conservation of linear momentum. We'll have boundary conditions. The normal boundary condition at the interface says that normal stress must be balanced by the curvature of the interface, where gamma, the surface tension, is a Forshawny constant. We need to have continuity of the tangential stress across the interface. This is a key point here, the kinematic boundary condition, which connects how the interface, which I'll define as R equals H, how that is coupled to the fluid flow through the normal component of the velocity field. And then we also need to have continuity of the velocity field along the axis. To close this problem, I haven't told you about the material. I haven't told you how the stress relates to gradients in the flow field. So we'll consider different cases. With Newtonian fluids, these are some experiments I did a while back with silicone oils. So for Newtonian fluids, basically the properties of fluid don't change. They change with temperature, for instance, but they don't change with the type of flow field you have. They're constant. Makes them very good to study. So in my experiment, this is just an example of my experiment, the drops are coming out of an orifice about 3 millimeters wide, and they're coming out about once every 30 seconds. And initially, the drop forms at the orifice, and there's a competition here between gravity and surface tension. When surface tension can no longer support the weight of the drop, it begins to fall. And as it falls, a filament forms connecting the droplet to the orifice. And over some time period, it appears to be uniform, cylindrical, in the axial direction, but then as the curvature increases at the droplet, that uniformity is lost at the connection to the droplet and at the orifice. And typically what happens for this fluid that's about 100 times more viscous than water is the drop pinches off first at the bottom and at the top, and then this satellite, or this free filament, collapses to form a satellite drop. We increase the viscosity of the fluid by 10, and what happens is that this droplet, so the fluid is still silicone oil, and all the properties are the same for these oils except the viscosity. What happens is this drop gets to be about an order of 10 longer, and what happens is this, it begins as it falls, and this is over, sorry, this is just 2.5 centimeters long, the drop continues to fall. We don't see it, but what we do see are instabilities form along that filament, and it causes pinch off into lots of satellite droplets. Okay, so this was something that I studied along with my advisor, Diane Henderson, and Harvey Seeger and Mickey Wakati. Harvey and Mickey came up with an exact solution for how a cylindrical filament stretches in time under gravity. And they have a prediction that the radius goes like 1 over the square root of time. We've made comparisons to fluids like these and found very good agreement for a range of viscosities. They also did a linear stability analysis of the exact solution, and the stability analysis correctly predicts whether you'll get what we call end pinching, pinching off at the ends, or internal pinching, where you have several pinches, pinches, which basically characterizes whether or not you'll get one satellite drop or several. Okay. So that was a Newtonian fluid. Now I want to talk to you about non-Newtonian fluids. They are much more interesting to study in the sense that now the properties of the fluids can change with gradients in the flow field. And so to illustrate to you this, the way that one measures this is through rheology. And so these are measurements that I took of the fluid here is 80-20 glycerol water, which is Newtonian. But I've added a polymer called xanthan gum. And xanthan gum is used in a lot of food products. You've probably eaten it probably in the last week or so. So what one property is called shear thinning. So what happens is as I change the rate of, at which I shear the fluid, the shear viscosity of the fluid actually decreases with shear rate. This bottom set of data here is just the solvent, just the glycerol water, which is Newtonian. And you can see as a function of shear rate, it's constant. But when I add the polymer, a very small amount, you can actually see that the viscosity is affected by the rate at which you shear it. These fluids can also strain harden. So if you put them in an extensional flow, they actually the extensional viscosity actually increases. So for a Newtonian fluid, the extensional viscosity is 3 times the shear viscosity, and this comes right out of Navier-Stokes equation. So for this solvent again, this is 80-20 glycerol water, this would be this red line would be the extensional viscosity for that fluid. So now as a function of the stretch rate, what we find is by adding a small amount of this xanthan gum polymer, you actually get a higher extensional viscosity. It appears not to be dependent on the stretch rate, but it increases. And the fluids I'll be looking at are 8 times more concentrated than this 100 part per million sample. So this is the key, one of the key ingredients to why spiders can create webs.
Excuse me. The increase you see in the Newtonian viscosity, is there a way to explain, understand it by the shear viscosity on the other side, or not necessarily, just a separate property?
So in this one, I am in a Coulomb plate rheometer, I'm shearing it. And in this one, this is actually not a measurement I took, but this is an extensional flow. You said Newtonian, and actually for both cases, the Newtonian fluid, well actually there's no measurement here for the Newtonian fluid, but the Newtonian fluid is constant. It's not varying, so I actually didn't catch your question.
So I'm wondering, in the case where you have the xanthan gum, for the apparent shear viscosity, can one understand the strain viscosity from those other values?
No. There's no linear relationship between from one flow field to another the response of the fluids. So this is another very interesting thing about non-Newtonian fluids. What you know is shear doesn't tell you what happens in extension. That's a really good question. Okay. So non-Newtonian fluids or viscoelastic fluids can also have elasticity. And so this is an experiment that was done by some of my colleagues at Penn State. And so what we're seeing here, these are 2 fluids, one Newtonian, one non-Newtonian. We're looking top down on a bowl of fluid. The bowl hasn't been filled to the top, but in this case it's filled with glycerol. There's a couple of markers. This and this are just markers on the bowl. And then these 2 particles here are placed on top of the fluid, so you can see they're tracer particles. Okay, the bowl was rotated at a constant rate until the fluid was in solid body rotation with the bowl, and then the motor was stopped. Okay, so it usually takes 2 tries to get this started, but it didn't quite work. We'll just start it again. All right. So what we see, I'll do that again. What you see is that once the bowl stops, particles stop pretty quickly. Okay, it doesn't take too long to dampen down. Now this is filled with a viscoelastic fluid, so we'll see what happens here. So again, this is the tracer particle. These are marks on the bowl, so they are fixed. Doesn't quite start right. So you can see that tracer particle snuck back and forth. Okay. Oops. So the fluid has memory of the stress that was imposed on it, and that's why you get the swing back effect. This is an elastic effect. Okay, this is the show and tell portion. So so now I want to tell you, what do we see with non-Newtonian filaments when we add this, the experiment that I showed you at the beginning with the Newtonian? What happens if I put in different types of viscoelastic fluid? So this fluid is an aqueous surfactant solution. The surfactant is composed of myocells, or amphiphiles that aggregate when placed in water into different geometries, in this case into cylinders. The size of these cylinders are around the size of a polymer. What's interesting about these micelles is that instead of the covalent bonds of a polymer that are very strong, these have hydrophobic, hydrophilic interactions, and so they easily break apart and reform in just a glass. So this is a freeze fracture image just to show you what those micelles look like top down. It's not necessarily true that there's actually connections here because we're looking top down. And here's what I see in my experiment. So this is a very concentrated micellar fluid. The same size orifice. And I apologize, this is just a bootleg animation here of my experiment. So what happens is it breaks off in a very localized region and snaps back like a rubber band. So it's not able to actually retract itself back into the orifice. I'll play that one more time. What's interesting is it appears to have changed to a solid, some sort of phase transition where it forgets it's a fluid, and you get this sort of yield failure that you see in a solid. I'd like to model what I think is a phase transition occurring here.
This is way beyond the CMC, so
that's right.
These things are not on the
interface.
They're actually the internal.
They're in the bulk. That's right.
So
these are not surfactants.
Something like xanthan.
Excuse me?
It would behave something like the xanthan, which lives in the bulk.
That's right. That's why we're making this comparison.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that the loop there at the end? Or is that a
That's right. So it forms an islet at the end.
I mean,
it actually curves back on itself. It wants. I'll show you another example. That's right. That's right. Sometimes like this, you go, whoa. And then you're in the lab. Okay. This is, if you're interested, I can tell you more about this problem. I'm sort of giving an introduction to the next talk. There's also an instability called beads on a string that's observed on viscoelastic filaments. This is more common with polymer solutions instead of those micellar solutions I just showed you. So what we observe, in this case, the drop came out of the same experimental setup. It dropped into a bowl, and there was a filament about this long connected between the two, and it continued to thin. And as it thins, this is what I saw. This filament thins down, and suddenly you see a perturbation grow. And that perturbation actually moves up. The size of this perturbation is about 10 times larger than the filament that's about the radius or the diameter of your hair, about 100 microns. So somehow, a viscoelastic filament can support a perturbation this large without pinching off. In the experiment, I actually have to sweep away the filament. It doesn't break. And you can actually get, along with migration, you can get coalescence with other instabilities. And this has actually been observed back in 1969 by Golden et al. There's been some very good experiments recently, experimental studies, and theoretical numerical results. And Fontolos will be talking about, Marcos will be talking about this next. Okay, so what I'm really interested in is this problem here. So I wanted to do a comparison between Newtonian and viscoelastic fluid. So I'm going to go back to that glycerol water solution. So in my experimental setup, again, this drop is coming. Drops are coming out once every 30 seconds. And it takes about 20 milliseconds, for the drop to actually pinch off from the faucet. And the length of it is about 1.4 centimeters when it pinches off. I then added a very small amount of xanthan gum to that solvent. And here's what I found. So the same flow rate, I measured the surface tension of these two fluids and they're nearly the same. And so that means that initially the amount of fluid coming out would be about the same because it's surface tension and the weight of the drop that dictate the amount, the volume initially coming out. And the flow is so slow, there really isn't a lot of new fluid coming in. So what I observe is that the drop falls, and it keeps falling, and I keep pulling my experiment up higher and higher and higher, and it's a meter long before it actually pinches off. And then actually what happens is this is about 5 centimeters long. I can't zoom in on the whole drop at once, but just looking at this portion, we see that between these two frames, the drop had to have pinched off, and the free filament actually can retract itself back into the orifice, so that's an elastic effect. This problem that I'm interested in is we have to conserve mass here, so we know that there's an exact solution for how a cylinder of fluid spins in time. And so the question I want to ask is, this took over a second to pinch off, and so there must be some different time scaling for how that decays in time, how it spins in time. So that's the problem I want to solve. Just to tell you that it is well known that viscoelasticity stabilizes filaments. That's been seen numerically and experimentally. It's also been seen that the thinning of the filament is known to slow down by increasing elasticity. You can do that by increasing polymer and the molecular weight of the polymer. And the mechanism that stabilizes the filament is the polymer's resistance to being extended. If the rate at which you extend it, the stretch rate is comparable to 1/2 the reciprocal relaxation time. And Hinch has a very nice paper showing numerical results of this. So back to the general. Now I'm going to solve the generalized filament problem. So we're going to consider an axisymmetric infinitely long filament of incompressible fluid. We're going to assume that we have an extensional flow where epsilon dot is the stretch rate. And to allow for gravitational effects, I'm going to add another function here, V, which is a function of T. The stretch rate is only a function of time. Again, the outer fluid is presumed to be inviscid and at rest. Gravity is acting downwards, defining the interface R to be H. The conservation of linear momentum equations written out in detail is given here. What I'll be doing is plugging in the velocity field into these equations. I need to specify a constitutive model. So the ones we'll be considering, I'll actually consider three versions, but the most generalized form of it is called the Olberg-B constitutive model. So lambda, let me just tell you about these parameters. Eta is the viscosity, dynamic shear viscosity. Lambda is the relaxation time of the fluid. Lambda sub r is the retardation time. If we set lambda and lambda r to zero, you have a Newtonian constitutive model. If I set lambda sub r equal to zero, this is called the upper convective Maxwell model. And combined, these are called the Olberg-B. This term here on the right-hand side is just a higher order solvent stress due to viscosity. So this doesn't really have any elastic effects. Elasticity is all in here. So what this we have stress due to elastic relaxation and due to viscous effects. So let me tell you also about this derivative. So this tensor derivative is called the upper convective derivative. You have your normal material derivative, and then you also have changes in stress due to translations within the flow. V here is the symmetric part of the velocity gradient tensor. So I have a velocity field. I can plug that in, write out what these components are. For an extensional flow field, you can actually show that the stress tensor is diagonal, and so the flow is shear free. The boundary conditions, I'm going to require that I'm actually only solving this for cylinder, so no perturbations. We're not getting to the beads problem at all. The normal stress condition, so I'm already using the fact that I have an extensional flow and a cylindrical filament. The normal stress condition reduces to this, tangential stress to this. And the key ingredient is the kinematic boundary condition, which simplifies it. Says the time rate of change of the interface is equal to 1/2 negative epsilon dot over H. So I can measure in my experiment how the radius changes in time. That's the one thing I can measure. So what I need to do here is find epsilon dot. And if I find epsilon dot, I can solve for H then I can compare to my experiments.
You're not including the thinning of the filament due to the fact that it's going faster as it goes down the gravity term.
Gravity is,
You're saying that H is a function only of T, right?
I'm allowing, gravity comes in at the velocity field, but it won't come in H.
Okay, so it's a small slope.
Yeah. Okay, so I've got a boundary value problem, a couple set of PDEs. I'd like to reduce it to a couple set of ODEs. So here's what I do. To simplify the free boundary problem, again, for cylindrical filament, I can rewrite the normal stress condition this way. So I'm just taking ddV of the normal stress condition. I want to come up with a expression for the pressure at the interface, so I use the axial momentum equation. I substitute it into here, take a derivative with respect to z, and out pops out this expression here. This expression is valid at r equals h. And so what it involves is a linear term in z with this stretch rate, a term that is only time dependent, that depends on that extra velocity component, and then the two components, the axial and radial stress components, derivatives with respect to z. To find an exact solution, this condition must be satisfied. And I'm going to use this to find a new exact solution. I haven't specified yet, so the stress depends on the gradients and the velocity. I haven't specified the constitutive model yet. So this condition has to hold for any fluid. So we make an observation. For a Newtonian fluid and an extension of flow, the stress is just time dependent. And so all the components are time dependent. So these two terms equal zero. And so remember, I need to find epsilon dot so I can find h. So to obtain a new exact solution, a more general class of solutions for viscoelastic fluids, I need to introduce axial dependence in either one of these two terms or both. And so that motivates the next assumption. So I'm going to look for power series expansion of the axial stress of this form, power series in Z. And I'm going to assume that the radial stress doesn't vary axially. So I plug this ansatz into that conditional statement here, collect terms in Z, and I end up with a set of ODEs. So we get an ODE describing the change rate of velocity of that V component of the stretch rate. And then what I find is that actually it's only up to the quadratic term that modifies the equations, these differential equations. All the cubic terms and higher are not needed in this expansion. So in fact, all I need to modify the dynamics to add viscoelasticity into the problem is to go up to a quadratic expansion. And of convenience, I'm going to choose this expansion. So C1 corresponds to B, C2 corresponds to A. Yeah?
The fact that you think you use the higher terms in the stress field expansion, that's basically because you have to assume it actually uniform.
Yeah. That's right.
And so if you have higher order contributions to the stress, you would get some jet profile. Could you just throw away your assumption of uniformity?
I have to think about that tonight. it's really important. There are so many different ways that cylindrical approximation came in that it would complexify the problem extremely. So probably I would want higher order terms, but all these equations would be much more involved. So for instance, the normal stress condition. This normal stress condition wouldn't be this simple. Okay, I would have variation in H in the axial direction. So the fact that dHdz equals zero is used frequently. Okay, so first I want to just I've got this coupled system. Well, I've just basically now got two ODEs for V and epsilon dot. And so let's consider the Newtonian case. For Newtonian fluid, the axial stress doesn't have any dependence in V at all. It just changes in time. And so that means that both A and B are zero in my expansion, and CFT is 2 eta times epsilon dot. So my stress components are given here. I substitute that into my ODEs, and I get the exact solution that was found by Seeger and Watati for the stretch rate, the velocity field, and using the kinematic boundary condition, I can find H. Simple interpretation of this is if you put this in Lagrangian coordinates, it just says that the fluid particles are in free fall. And then in order to conserve mass, you've got this filament that's stretching, it must thin in time in order to conserve mass. Okay, so now I'm going to solve the problem for an Olgroid B fluid. So now again, here's my constitutive model. The only term I need is the axial stress. So given this Olgroid B model with the velocity field, this is the evolution, it's not even an evolution equation, this is the PDE for how the axial stress changes. So what I do is I substitute my quadratic expansion in for TDZ, and I collect powers of Z, and I come up with 5 coupled ODEs. These ODEs are for epsilon dot V, and then those components of my expansion for A, B, and C. These are coupled, and what I want to point out now is that the equation for epsilon dot has been modified by the quadratic coefficient in my expansion. And so now I'm going to be expecting some different time dependence in the flow field. I notice that the equations for epsilon dot and A are decoupled from the others, so we'll go about solving those. Before, so we'll just non-dimensionalize these equations with the scalings. We're going to scale time with relaxation time and velocity with gravity. And so these are now the coupled ODEs to solve, including the kinematic condition. So the capital letters now are non-dimensional quantities. When you non-dimensionalize, 3 parameters pop out, dimensionless parameters. A quantity called the Deber number, which is super duper important. It relates the relaxation time of the fluid to the initial A sub 0, is the initial value for the quadratic coefficient. So this is the relationship between the initial stress posed on the fluid and the relaxation time. Psi is product of Reynolds number and Froude number, and omega is just the relationship between that retardation time and relaxation time. If I considered an upper convected Maxwell fluid, omega would be 0. And the only equation that would change here is for C. It's the only one that has omega. This is the time-dependent term in the axial stress. So the exact solution we'll find applies both to the upper convected Maxwell and Olgroid B fluids models. We also impose these initial conditions to solve the problem. So again, A, the equations for A and the stretch rate E are independent of each other. The solution for A is quite simple. Just have exponential decay. So now that I have the solution to that, I plug it into the equation for the stretch rate to solve the stretch rate. So once I substitute in exponential decay, I notice that this is has a general form of a Riccati equation, which you can transform with this change of variables. You get a second order ODE, which can be transformed again into a modified Bessel equation, whose solution is the sum of these modified Bessel functions, whose arguments have this exponential decay. And now that we have W, we can go ahead and find the stretch rate E. And here's now what the stretch rate is for this viscoelastic fluid. Now that I have the stretch rate, I can go ahead and solve for how the radius changes in time. And in fact, what we get is that the radius goes like 1 over the square root of these modified Bessel functions. This parameter alpha is just a constant. It depends on the initial stretch rate and the Deber number, delta. So we consider different limits of this. In the long time behavior of this viscoelastic solution, as tau goes to infinity, we found that the stretch rate goes like 1 over t plus t infinity. T infinity is just some constant. And this is independent of the Deber number delta. You can see that delta appears in the solution for stretch rate. The Newtonian solution in non-dimensional form goes like 1 over t plus t naught, or tau, sorry, tau plus tau naught, where tau naught is a time offset determined by the reciprocal of the initial stretch rate. It's always a positive quantity for Newtonian solution. So what we find is that in the long-term behavior of this viscoelastic solution, the influence of the viscoelastic effects is to the underlying Newtonian solution is to actually modify the effective initial condition. So tau infinity could be considered 1 over the reciprocal of E sub infinity, say. And we can find the effect that we have an exact solution. The existence of that allows us to write a connection formula between the initial data comparing tau infinity to tau naught. In fact, we can say that tau infinity in the limit, in this asymptotic limit, goes like 1 over stretch rate minus tau. And this quantity will depend on both tau naught and delta, the Deborah number. So Tom and I, talking back and forth to each other, realized that things weren't quite making sense at the beginning, but we probed a little bit more and we found out that actually our solution defines two different limits, a weakly and a strongly viscoelastic limit. And so if you look in the limit, so given this quantity for tau infinity, we fix a value for tau naught. What we find is that this offset parameter, tau infinity, actually is positive, but then it can go negative after some critical value. I'll come back to that in a second, that idea. Given the expression for tau infinity, we could use the kinematic condition to determine the long-time asymptotics of how the radius changes in time. And the radius goes like some h infinity, which again is some offset of the initial value for h. H sub 0 is just 1, so this would be this could be a quantity not equal to 1. And the Newtonian solution usually goes like 1 over the square root of t plus t naught, but now we have to use absolute value here because of the fact that t infinity could become actually negative. And this is how we find h infinity. So what we found is that where tau infinity goes through 0, the stretch rate, which is the reciprocal of that quantity, diverges. And this is the borderline between being weakly viscoelastic to left or strongly viscoelastic to the right. Viscoelastic is in some measure a measure given by delta. So if you're weakly viscoelastic, that means your delta is very small. Strongly viscoelastic means your delta is large. And what we find is that comparing to what has been observed experimentally, is that for small delta, as delta increases, tau infinity actually decreases. This is before we hit this critical value. In terms of h, as that happens, in this, let me explain this diagram here. These are graphs of the radius as a function of tau, time, non-dimensional time. And so the way you should read these graphs is that as the absolute value of tau infinity is increasing, there's actually a time delay in the thinning of the filament. So it actually doesn't decrease rapidly until after some period of time. So for delta very small, tau infinity is actually decreasing. So actually, we could look the other direction. For small, for weakly viscoelastic case, actually the time delay decreases before you get thinning to the tau to negative 1/2 behavior. But on the other side of this borderline, as delta increases, tau infinity actually increases too. And so in the strongly viscoelastic case, the offset, the time offset or time delay before you get thinning, and this scaling of this thinning is the same scaling as the Newtonian solution, that time delay increases. This is actually was something seen experimentally by Anna and McKinley in experiments and also by Amroshen. So it's more common to actually be in this regime than in this regime here.
So you do have finite time blow up for tau infinity, is
maybe we can talk about that
yeah.
later. Yeah. there's one plot that I haven't provided in my presentation here. So there is, I believe, finite time blow up, I'm not prepared to talk about it just right now. Okay, so what happens, though, so what we're seeing here is that eventually, as time increases, eventually the solution will scale, like order 1,000⁻⁰, which is the behavior of a Newtonian fluid. If you look in different limits, if you look in the limit of small delta, you can actually define this borderline. So again, when tau infinity goes to zero, the reciprocal of that quantity diverges, which is a measure of the stretch rate, non-dimensional stretch rate. So the dividing line is actually defined by this E sub zero critical, which goes like 2 over delta squared. Again, that's the Deber number. So for the case of small delta, if you are in this region, you're considered weakly viscoelastic. And outside of this quantity and to the right of this critical value, you're considered to be in a strongly viscoelastic regime. These correspond to tau infinity either being positive or to negative. These dots here represent experiments that I conducted, 9 different experiments, and all of them are in the strongly viscoelastic regime. So here's the experiments. So what we did in the experiments was given a particular experiment, measured the radius of the filament at some fixed location z over the time period when the filament was nearly cylindrical. So I would not have started taking data here, but waited some time between these two images to actually start taking measurements. Continued to take measurements until it appears to be not cylindrical anymore. So that would maybe be some frames later. We made a best fit of that data to the exact solution, constrained by values for these alpha, constants for alpha given here. And here is the data from 9 experiments. So these are xanthan gum fluids in the glycerol water solution with and without salt. We used 4 different fluids, and there's nothing really to tell. There's nothing that I want to distinguish them except to say that while the data is given by circles and aligned by the fits, and we can see that we do a very good job of fitting the data the prediction to the data. One thing I would like to point out is that the relaxation times of these fluids are very different than what are measured in shear rheology. In shear rheology, relaxation time of these fluids is on the order of about 10 seconds. And given these fits, the relaxation time is the order of about 10^-2 seconds. And so it's very different than what's measured in shear rheology.
Tau is time normalized by lambda or by epsilon dot?
By lambda, by the relaxation time. So concerned about this, I was at HUI this summer and the topic was non-Newtonian fluids, and I asked Hinch about this. And he said that within shear rheology and extensional flows, you need not get the same relaxation time. So we're actually seeing that in our experiments. You can see that eventually it appears to scale like scale in a power law way. This is on a log-log scale. So I want to talk about what's happening with the solution. This is the last slide. So we observed that there seems to be a transition from what we call viscoelastic to Newtonian scaling. Newtonian scaling is given by this thin solid line here. So this is order t^-1/2. It has slope of -1/2. And we can see that after some time period, it appears to actually scale that way. And if we look at the asymptotic behavior for h of tau, that's given by this dashed line. We actually see that it does scale like tau^-1/2. So over this regime, I would say the fluid is acting viscoelastic. And then here, it's acting Newtonian. And the question is, why is that happening? And it goes back to that critical stretch rate. So remember that Hinch showed that if the extension rate of the fluid is strong enough, polymer molecules actually stretch. And when they're stretched, they add elasticity to the fluid. When that stretch rate is not strong, when it's less than the reciprocal of the relaxation time, 1/2 of that quantity, the polymer molecules just coil up. And you essentially just have macromolecules that are basically little balls in your fluid. And they're not adding any viscoelastic effects. They're just spheres in your fluid. So what I'm plotting here is for the fit that we did to H here, I also have an exact solution for the stretch rate. So given those fitted parameters for H, I've plotted here in the dark solid line the corresponding stretch rate as a function of time, non-dimensional time. The critical stretch rate is given by that dashed line. So if the stretch rate is above this quantity, the polymer molecules are stretching, and if it's below, the polymer molecules are actually coiling up. And so it's over this time regime, this early time regime, that there's actually any elasticity effects in the fluid. And beyond that, the fluid is basically just acting Newtonian. The time at which that transition occurs is basically the transition we observe from sort of the viscoelastic to the Newtonian scaling. And so we would argue that what's happening on the microscopic level is actually dictating what we observe on the macroscopic level. You asked a loaded question. So actually, I won't go back to the older B model, but so at least numerically, the older B model at this critical stretch rate in extensional flow developed infinite extensional stress, and thus infinite, it actually strain hardens, and you get infinite extensional viscosity. And so, so your question again was, if you, so the Oldberg B model actually, so it's developed from a molecular theory and from the, using statistical mechanics brings it up to the continuum level. And so the only way that you would observe, you wouldn't actually in Oldberg B model see the polymer molecules actually stretching or coiling. But what you would observe is in the stress. If I showed plots of the stress, you would see that the stress would actually, if the polymer molecules were stretching, you'd see a build up in the stress, and then if the polymer molecules are relaxing, you see a taper off of the stress. So the stress without any polymer molecules goes like 1 over time, and you would and that we actually see that in our our plots of the stress.
How much more realism is added by the lambda R?
Not much. Not much. So
it's a little easier to understand.
Yeah, so we actually explored that. In the long time limit, there's very little difference between the two. So that's all I have to say.
So you would get similar results if you adjusted to
the lambda. So let me just say that these results are independent of lambda sub r. So I want to point out again that the solutions for E and H are the same for upper convected Maxwell and the older B models. The only difference is in that is in the time dependence of the stress between these the upper convected Maxwell and older B models. So if I plotted I had that quadratic expansion for the stress, and the last term was C of tau. C of tau would be the only term affected by lambda sub r. So I guess the only thing for the conclusions, we have a new exact solution. We found that it's long time limit, independent of the Deber number. The exact solution does converge to the known Newtonian solution. In the weakly viscoelastic limit, the filament behaves like a Newtonian filament all along for all time. In the strongly viscoelastic limit, I didn't have a chance to talk about it, but there are some transient dynamics. And we have very good comparison between experimental data and the theory. And we believe that the transient dynamics that we observe is due to a stretch-to-coil transition of the polymer molecules. And the last thing, and this is actually opening a whole can of worms, is the next step would be to consider the stability analysis of this exact solution, which is not trivial because you have, if you consider Raleigh's case for the jet, you had constant velocity and you have a radius that's constant. For steady flow. In this case, H is changing with time. The radius is changing with time. So it's a very difficult problem to solve. But it's something I like to do. And the way we formulated the problem also, we could insert other constitutive models. And for instance, the next step would be to consider a model that has bounded stress that allows only finite extensional effects. That's it.